The following talk was given by Mary Sullivan at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 16, 2021. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
So good morning, everyone. So up until yesterday afternoon, I really felt I had nothing to say, absolutely nothing. I did come up with a title for this talk finally yesterday, and then this morning I promptly forgot what the title is. It's been that kind of month, 2 months, so I'm going to throw out a title because I'm not going to remember the one that I liked better that I had earlier, and the title I am substituting for it is With Purity Like a Lotus. So because I had absolutely nothing to say as of yesterday afternoon, I wanted to start out by saying today is my niece's 31st birthday. This is the niece that survived Hurricane Andrew back in 1992 when she was 2 years old. And my brother and sister-in-law and she were living in a homestead when Hurricane Andrew blew through Homestead, Florida, devastated it, and blew Homestead Air Force Base off the map. She is now working for the U.S. Census Bureau. She is has a doctorate, a Ph.D. in economics. Needless to say, she's at least 100 times better in math than I am, but I think everybody except my cats are better than I am at math. So she's doing really well. She's living in D.C., and I'm going to have to call her and wish her a happy birthday because I'm not a very good aunt, to be quite honest. The reason I felt I had nothing to say was because I don't react well to feeling helpless, and I have felt helpless. So, for example, there's the escalating Israeli-Hamas conflict. And in fact, Israel blew up the Associated Press building yesterday after warning the occupants that they were going to do so, which was fortunate. Then there is the state of the pandemic in India, such that, they're running out of wood for the ritual cremations, not to mention oxygen, not to mention vaccine. And then there is Viktor Orban, the prime minister of Hungary, who has, he has passed a law transferring control of the country's 11 main state universities to a series of foundations that will likely be run by government allies. So Mr. Orban refers to his government as an illiberal democracy, and this is one of his illiberal reforms. I also made the mistake of listening to the World on my way home from work the other day, and they were talking about the Syrian government using chemical warfare against its own people, and pregnant women gave birth to seriously birth defected babies. Listen to the news, don't listen to the news. Who knows what to do anymore? I sure don't. And my reaction to that was more or less just to shut down completely. But I had said I would give a talk, so here I am giving a talk. And let me warn you, it's going to start out very strangely. Most of the people who come to Dharma Field and who listen to the talks are men, and this is aimed at women. In honor of a week after Mother's Day and because of an interview that Terry Gross conducted on Thursday that I listened to on my way home from work from downtown St. Paul with Linda Griffith. I was thoroughly intrigued by this interview. I don't know if any of you heard this. I really like Terry Gross. I like Fresh Air. And I had no idea who Linda Griffith was. So, um, Oh, another thing was, David suggested that instead of talking, I just sit in front of the camera and maintain a noble silence. But honestly, maybe Vimla Kurti can pull that off, but I can't. I thought that the topic might be shame. I have been talking about shame with a good friend. It's a complex topic. And part of it was thought was because of this interview that Terry Gross conducted with Linda Griffith. Linda Griffith is an MIT bioengineer. She is the recipient of the MacArthur Foundation grant, otherwise known as the Genius Grant. She has taught endocrinology at Harvard. She co-founded in 1994 the MIT Center for, get this, gynecology research. Terry Gross introduces her and notes that she was instrumental in creating MIT's biological engineering department and in helping to recruit her future husband, Doug Laufenberger, to head it. This is Linda's story, so I didn't look up Doug. So I really don't know anything about Doug, except he's married to Linda. So they were jointly awarded a prize for creating the discipline of biological engineering. She has received so many awards and accolades that I was really impressed when I heard her list of accomplishments. She is a full professor at one of the world's most prestigious universities, which is MIT. So what is gynecology? This is where the talk gets really strange if you're a guy, and I'm sorry, but we're going there. Linda Griffith suffered terribly from endometriosis. If you are unsure what it is, I'll tell you. It is, of course, a women's issue. And when talking about endometriosis, one necessarily has to talk about gynecology. And there are many shameful topics, heaven knows, in gynecology. The endometrium is the lining of a woman's uterus. Endometriosis is essentially abnormal growth or migration of this tissue into other organs. It continues to grow there in those organs, and it is an incredibly painful disorder. So Linda Griffith was diagnosed with endometriosis in 1988. The first question that Terry Gross asks her is, it's a very usual question, one that a person specializing in gynecology would be expected to know. She asks Linda, what causes endometriosis? And I really appreciated Linda's honesty. She said, so we don't know what exactly causes it. And then she goes on to state that the lining, the endometrium, can invade the bladder, the bowel, the lining of the abdomen. She didn't say this, but it's like an invasive species. It can land on the ovaries and cause cysts. At this point, and the transcript of the interview doesn't capture it, I hear Linda as very, very angry, even as she says her first words, so we don't know. She sounded so annoyed, not with Terry, but with the ignorance and shame surrounding having endometriosis. Terry then asks her why it causes so much pain. Any woman who has had endometriosis can certainly vouch for how painful the condition is. Again, I admire Linda's honesty. While being taken aback by all the anger in her voice, she states, again, we don't know all the reasons. I really have to admire her for that. There's a lot of speculation, she says. I'm going to stop here and emphasize that Linda herself used the word speculation. And I'm going to come back to this. Linda says there's a lot of speculation why it causes so much pain. In my recollection of this interview, I thought I heard Terry press Linda about why that's so. And then Linda clearly seems to make up an answer. After all, she had already spoken the truth. They don't know. She then speculates that there is inflammation coming from leaking blood. There are little lesions growing in the abdomen that can bleed, that cause blood vessels to become very leaky. So she's offered a circular argument. And what is causing this is completely unclear. She then states that an accumulation of blood can cause inflammation, and this can send pain signals. She then likens this to a paper cut. And man, at this point, I think she is flying by the seat of her pants. I am not at all sure about what she says causes inflammation. I think that, like the pain of endometriosis, no one really knows what causes inflammation. In medicine, inflammation is a very complex topic. It's central to disciplines like rheumatology. And if you remember at the start of the pandemic, people who had inflammatory conditions were thought to be at higher risk of getting COVID. So it's a very central, complex topic. And truly, I don't think anybody knows what causes inflammation. There's even been for a long time, there was an understanding that the brain did not get inflamed. There was a mechanism in the brain that prevented inflammation because it would lead to swelling. But that's not true. There's swelling in the brain. So it's a very complex, intricate topic affecting many areas of medicine. But it seems so important to Linda to answer that question. Why? Even if it means resorting to speculation and making stuff up on the spot. Because it seems like if we can just pin down the cause of this pain and the cause of the inflammation, then we can legitimize Linda's terrible suffering and the suffering of other women who've had this condition. In our absolute desperation to answer the question why, we are forced to resort to conceptualization, to trying to narrow or pin things down in whatever way possible to come up with an answer. This, we think, will save us. Linda's suffering will not have been for naught. So then Terry Gross asks her about the extent of her pain. Linda, again sounding irritated, says, "I had terribly debilitating pain, terribly debilitating pain." And she goes on to describe how she got to be in constant pain until she had surgery to remove scar tissue, which I suspect they have no idea whereof its cause. Linda, with some renewal of her confidence, supplies us with a name for the scar tissue, fibrosis. Note how you may have felt reassured just by hearing there's a name for it. So this is our human ignorance. We think that by naming it, we can ease our suffering. And there's nothing wrong with this, but it's mistaken. However, as the second noble truth points out, this is one of the ways in which ignorance arises, the attempt to get rid of pain. So Terry asks another question. Where are you now in terms of endometriosis? And Linda goes on to say that she has had 9 major surgeries, and her first surgery was a hysterectomy. Note, this did not cure her endometriosis. After her 9th surgery for endometriosis, get this, she was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. Triple negative refers to the absence of hormone receptors, and this is all tied up with genetics. the whole discipline of oncology is actually intimately linked with human and involved with human genetics. Triple negative refers to cancer that tests negative for receptors for the hormones estrogen and progesterone and for an excess of HER2 protein. This absence of receptors has profound implications for how triple negative breast cancer is treated. So actually, my admiration for Linda keeps growing. Oncology is a discipline about which I have no knowledge. It has a language of its own. I trained with neurologists when I got to the U to do my postdoc here, and I feel I know more neurology than I do psychology, even though I'm a psychologist. However, oncology is a totally alien discipline to me. The language, the treatments, the side effects are all quite complex. So Linda then says that she underwent aggressive chemotherapy for this triple negative breast cancer. And since then, she has not suffered any more symptoms of endometriosis. And boy, do I admire honesty. She admits that she does not know whether that ninth surgery or the aggressive chemotherapy cured her endometriosis. But I noticed this did not make her anger go away. She goes on to talk about the frequency of endometriosis in the human population, in the female population. It's 1 in 10. She then says that given that frequency, quote, you'd think that everybody would be talking about it. She notes that possibly the shame associated with talking about a woman's bodily functions is responsible for the lack of discussion. Then she noted that some women just don't understand what she went through in terms of pain because they don't have the same symptoms. Terry noted that it usually takes years for women to be diagnosed with endometriosis. But then I start to get a glimpse of why Linda is so angry. First, even some women gynecologists found it hard to believe how much pain is associated with the disorder. She says some women gynecologists think women should not talk about it because it makes them look weak. Doctors, Linda says, would often try to talk her down from her symptoms, as she put it, by saying, oh, this is normal. You're under stress. And Linda continues by providing some rather graphic descriptions of her suffering during times of menstruation that, thankfully, I'm not going into. She simply felt disqualified by the professionals treating her. And then, as I thought more and more about this interview, I began to have more ideas or more thoughts about why Linda was so angry, and I'll get to that. Much of the rest of the interview I didn't hear because I had arrived home. The transcript of the interview reveals that Linda is now researching endometriosis, inflammation, the connection between the digestive system and the brain. I don't know if you know it, but the digestive system, the gut, has recently been called the second brain. I know. And the interview was very interesting. Another very interesting comment that I did hear her make before I got home is that endometriosis affects women of all races around the world. She noted that at the time of her own diagnosis in 1988, you didn't talk about gynecology. She then goes on to talk about how she is building different kinds of mathematical models to describe how information flows inside a cell, between cells, and between different organs in the body. I recommend the interview if you're interested. And then later, it began to dawn on me. I suspect Linda is angry because she's been working on this problem of inflammation, of endometriosis, since She and her husband started this lab of biological engineering in 1994, and they have yet even to understand, if you can talk about cause, what are the causes of pain? Why is endometriosis painful? What causes endometriosis? Why does this lining migrate to different organs and stay there? What are the mechanisms? And they've been researching this, and I suspect they still have no answers. And that's another source of her anger. I was just reading Judy McConnell's comment. Oh, Judy, I can apologize for virtually anything. But anyway, I really like this interview. I really, really appreciated Linda's honesty, given her prominence in the academic world and her acknowledgement that they still really don't know. But I want to return to the word speculation. All or much of what Linda is now focusing her research on is in the service of reducing speculation about a common disorder in women, a disorder that occurs in 1 in 10 women. Yet it is premised on more speculation, on concepts, on ideas. As Steve Hagen has pointed out, the scientific method itself is impeccable, but science is in the business of playing with ideas. As Steve has put it, the conceptual is the natural home of science. But what really makes for speculation? I'm going to turn to the part of this talk that actually has something to do with practice, with Buddhism. So in Jed's class, we've had been studying Song of Awakening by Yoga Daishi. Very interesting poem. Very complex. On page 2 of the poem, it says, when you experience the truth, you are without speculation. And Jed actually commented on this in the last class. I realized what the name of my talk that I first came up with was. It was Always Experiencing Enlightenment. So as Steve has gone to great lengths to point out, we are always experiencing the truth. The truth is all we know, as he points out. Any other claims to knowledge are knowledge of things out there. But truth is not knowledge of anything. The truth is experienced directly. There really is no other way to say it. When we abandon claims to knowing about things and just pay attention to, again, to use words used over and over again, just pay attention to immediate direct experience without an overlay of ideas, speculation ends. Speculation in and of itself is not bad, but it is painful because it leads one away from truth. Although there really is no leaving truth behind. We can't leave truth behind. Speculation is painful because it is not awareness of immediate direct experience. It points in the opposite direction. It is, as we say in Zen, somewhat smugly, sniffing at the finger, pointing at the moon, rather than seeing the moon itself. So I just want to stop for a minute because this occurred to me after I'd written all of this. I was thinking about the expression moon in a dewdrop, and it has a relationship to the title of my class, which I don't remember what I just said. But Dogen, for example, talks about grasses and pebbles, tiles and stones, all are mind. And this startles our ears. And then the image of the moon reflecting in the being reflected in the dewdrop is a teaching on no boundaries, no limits. I don't know, but it also expresses, I realized, no matter where we look, enlightenment, awakening, truth is everywhere. It's ubiquitous. This moon, by the way, moon is a symbol of enlightenment. So it can be reflected in the water, in a dewdrop, in a drop of rain on the grass, wherever on the grass, which itself is mind. So wherever we look, there's awakening, there's enlightenment, there's truth. I know people get impatient hearing this, but I just invite you to notice your experience. The best place to do this is in Zen practice and meditation. As Steve has pointed out, there are no boundaries around experience. No boundaries. This, you can see this. A sound arises. You did not bid the sound to arise, and you cannot make it cease. It simply arises and then ceases. There is no boundary around the sound of, say, birds chirping. This is what Suzuki meant, it seems to me, when he said he just wanted to teach his students how to listen to the sound of the blue jay. Steve Matushak talked about this a few weeks ago. Suzuki also puts it another way. He says, mind includes everything. What else? As my sister would say, that annoys me when she says that. The experience of a subject or I in meditation. Try to focus on that. Try to pin that down. Try to grasp that. Try to hold on to that. When I try to do that in meditation, somehow there ends up being some vague awareness of the vicinity of my forehead or my open eyes. Notice what happens to that experience in the next moment. It simply ceases while there is the arising of other experiences. It does not last. It is, as we say, empty of any persistence, of any self-nature. It has no substance. So, as I said earlier, speculation is not bad, but it is painful. It was so interesting to hear this woman of such tremendous academic achievements and accomplishment go from a totally honest answer of I don't know to speculation of the medical world's packaging of a disorder. That is very painful. Indeed, one could talk about the whole packaging of the concept of pain. Being in pain seems almost shameful in and of itself. No one wants to hear you talk about your pain, but in fact, we all experience pain. It is interesting that the medical profession has evolved the practice of asking people routinely to rate the severity of their pain on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the most severe pain. I've heard it hypothesized that all of this emphasis on rating one's pain at the doctor's office has led to doctors prescribing more and more pain-relieving medication, such as opioids. And as we all know by now, there is an opioid addiction epidemic in this country. The judgment of pain as something bad, as something that needs to be eliminated, seems to have contributed to this. So we think we are going to eliminate ignorance by packaging it differently, conceptually. We will create mathematical models of the flow of information within a cell, between cells, and among organs. But the Buddha had a much more subtle understanding of ignorance. He understood ignorance to have its roots in a lack of awareness. This brings us to intention. one of the Buddha's great insights was into intention, human intention. We talk about this here at Dharma Field as, quote, leaning of mind, unquote. I was very intrigued a few weeks back to hear Jeff, whose last name I can't remember, note that he did not understand what leaning of mind is or what it referred to. So in the talk a week or so later, Steve Hagen gave some beautiful examples of this. And Steve Matushak talked about this as well, because Jeff's question came up during Steve's talk. Actually, you know, it's not hard to see our minds lean. This is wanting, this is craving, this is grasping, or this is rejecting. Leaning of mind can also be very subtle. One of the most subtle yet obvious manifestations has to do with trying to get something from meditation. I can sit there and try to trust in awareness or trust in experience, and I've done it. First of all, there is packaging of the word trust. I've tried to conceptualize it, which results in turning trust into a concept, something out there to attain. I lean toward wanting to trust. I lean toward wanting to experience trust, which is really packaging it as an idea, something out there apart from this experience. So this is leaning of mind. But in that, there is even something more subtle. Because if I can just learn to trust whatever that is, I can get something. What that is hard to explain. But when it is happening, I can see that it is happening. I can see leaning of mind. Not leaning of my mind, just leaning of mind. Just that inclination to grasp some idea about trusting experience. You know, I've learned really not to mess with this. I can't even say that I try to let it go anymore. I do return to my breath, to noticing breathing in as I breathe in, to noticing breathing out as I breathe out. This focus on my breath does not last. I get involved in thought again, over and over. But once again, the mind settles itself with the effort not to get too involved with that awareness of over-involvement in thought. Is that leaning of mind? Not really. As long as that does not become wanting this awareness to last or packaging this awareness as a goal, then it is not leaning of mind. Of course, I've wanted that calmness to last, that release from the tumult of my mind, however temporary. But in noticing that leaning, the mind settles down. I've come back to something Norm has talked about on a number of occasions for many years. He spoke of being in his first session with Katagiri. He found himself experiencing all sorts of thoughts and insights, believed himself to be making enormous progress, and all in his first session. This was astonishing to him. So he had Dokusan with Katagiri, and he started to tell him all about his great insights, hoping that Katagiri would praise him for them and for the progress he was already making and in his first session of all things. Let me hasten to point out that this is a truly great example of leaning of mind. Norm really wanted to get something from this experience, and then he wanted to show it off. And I'm sure he will forgive me for saying this, because he always laughs when he tells the story. So now I have a confession to make. It has taken me years to understand Katagiri's response to Norm. Katagiri completely ignored the content of what Norm was saying. He went right to the heart of the matter. He said, basically, forget all that. Instead, he asked Norm, how's your breathing? How's your posture? How's your mind? These are the elements of Zen practice. The posture, the breath, the mind. Body, mind, and breath. I've become conscious of how I slump in meditation. I return to the posture. I am involved in thought. There is returning to the breath. There is a disturbed, distracted mind. Somehow, with some attention to body and breath and to awareness of what is happening without judging that, there is a calmer mind. There is some abandonment of leaning toward wanting to get something or leaning toward wanting to get rid of something. So Katagiri was pointing to the heart of Zen practice, awareness of body, mind, breath, awareness. So what does this have to do with shame? Have you ever noticed how people try to get you to believe in the way they want you to believe or to think or speculate by resorting to shame? This, of course, is leaning a mind, wanting someone to believe the way we do. Shame also has to do with judgment. There is judgment that another way of seeing things is not acceptable, is bad, is not to be tolerated. This is shame. Linda could not talk about how much pain she was in because it simply did not accord with the prevalent beliefs at the time about the nature of such pain and what might cause it. There is a story about a Jewish physician in Vienna in the early 1920s. Practicing at a time when, believe it or not, there was ignorance among other physicians about basic hygiene practice. Women were dying in childbirth because these physicians were not washing their hands prior to delivering babies or during doing surgery such as C-sections. Here we are back to women in gynecology. It turns out that C-sections actually became relatively safe and were in use around the 1500s and 1600s, if you can believe that. But in any case, these physicians at the time might go directly from excavating corpses for study in the lab to delivering a baby or doing a C-section without washing their hands. When this physician tried to point out that maybe there was a connection between the women's dying of some infection and the fact that the doctors were not washing their hands prior to delivering the babies, he was made a laughing stock of Viennese society. It also did not help that he was Jewish. He ended up committing suicide. Such can be the impact of shame. Shame is really judgment. I like the 10th precept because it points directly to judging. It says, self-nature is clear and obvious. Within the one Dharma, not holding a dualistic view of ordinary and enlightened, is called the precept of not abusing the three treasures. This is not abusing the three treasures. This is not to make a distinction, not to make a judgment about ordinary and enlightened. To make a judgment about enlightened as somehow better than ordinary. The three treasures are, of course, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the precept points to our tendency to lean toward some idea of one of the treasures as somehow more worthy or more precious or more whatever than the others. This, of course, is leaning a mind. The precepts are quite adept at pointing to how our minds lean. And Steve is going to get into that in his class on self-nature, being clear and obvious. So in this Song of Awakening that we've been studying with Jed, on page 4, Yoga Daishi says, to reject delusion and grasp at the truth, suits perfectly the mind of like and dislike. The mind of dislike and like is leaning mind, the mind that separates out delusion and truth, the mind that judges one as good and desirable and the other as bad and undesirable. As pointed out in many places, delusion and enlightenment are not two. Samsara and nirvana are not two different places. Without delusion, there is no enlightenment. Without enlightenment, delusion makes no sense. I also wanted to point something out that I've noticed about a reframing that Bruce Santillanes has done in a couple of his talks, when he talks about intoxication and sobriety. I would imagine that in the world of chemical dependency treatment, intoxication is extremely a delicate topic. It's a topic around which there's a lot of shame. And I really like what Bruce says. He points out that intoxication and sobriety are not two different things. Each is dependent upon the other. You can't have one without the other. And I really like the way he handles that, because it really points to how not to judge, among other things. So now, in my final minutes of the talk, about which I had nothing to say, I'm going to turn to Huang Po. Huang Po says, on page 37 of Blofeld's translation, hang on. When the people of the world hear it said that the Buddhas transmit the doctrine of the mind, they suppose that there is something to be attained or realized apart from mind, And thereupon they use mind to seek the Dharma, not knowing that mind and the object of their search are one. Mind cannot be used to seek something from mind. For then, after the passing of millions of eons, the day of success will not have dawned. Such a method is not to be compared with suddenly eliminating conceptual thought, which is fundamental Dharma. Suppose a warrior, forgetting that he was already wearing his pearl on his forehead, were to seek for it elsewhere. He could travel the whole world without finding it. But if someone who knew what was wrong were to point it out to him, the warrior would immediately realize that the pearl had been there all the time. So if you students of the way, meaning us, are mistaken about your own real mind, not recognizing that it is the Buddha, you will consequently look for him elsewhere, indulging in various achievements and practices and expecting to attain realization by such graduated practices. But even after eons of diligent searching, you will not be able to attain the way. These methods cannot be compared to the sudden elimination of conceptual thought. In the certain knowledge that there is nothing at all which has absolute existence, nothing on which to lay hold, nothing on which to rely, nothing in which to abide, nothing subjective or objective. And actually, I didn't write out the whole quote, but I'm going to go ahead and finish it. It is by preventing, that's a tricky word. I don't know how you prevent the rise of conceptual thought, except by seeing through it, seeing that you will realize Bodhi. And when you do, you will just be realizing the Buddha who has already existed in your own mind, who has always existed in your own mind. Eons of striving will prove to be so much wasted effort. Just as when the warrior found his pearl, he merely discovered what had been hanging on his forehead all the time. And just as his finding of it had nothing to do with his efforts to discover it elsewhere. So this quote points to our mistakes, but it also points to our true nature, which is nothing but mind. There is nothing, as Wang Po says, but the one mind. And when we attempt to somehow use this or turn awareness into a search for something outside of what's of awareness, then we are, as he says, like that warrior searching for the pearl that's always in our possession, that's hanging from our forehead, that we think we've lost, but really never have. This is tricky. This is a tricky, tricky thing. Because it's subtle, because it points to our, what we do all the time. And sometimes we're largely unaware of it. I also wanted to read another quote from Song of Awakening by Yoko Daishi. He says on page 2, he says, the wish-fulfilling pearl is not recognized by beings, but here it is within the matrix of reality as a continual presencing. Continual presencing. I love that expression. This is practice. This is Zen practice. This is awareness, continual presencing. And he says, the wish-fulfilling pearl is not recognized by beings. And I think by beings, he means when we try to use mind to seek mind, when we try to use our awareness to seek awareness as though we're something outside of what was actually happening, of what we actually are. As Yoko Daishi says, one finds oneself the source of all things and one's own nature to be awake awareness. So that couplet was the first thing that caught my attention when I read this, when Jed started teaching this class. One finds oneself the source of all things and one's own nature to be awake awareness. And I'm not going to say trust that, because then immediately it's something to get. It's something to go after. And we just have to not. Yes. Well, anyway, boy, that's the longest I've talked and I had nothing to say. I had nothing to say. So I'm done talking. I'm opening it up to questions. And Mike has a question.
More of a comment. I just wanted to say that I have a sister who suffered from endometriosis. So, she suffered greatly. She ended up after several surgeries having to take hormones for life to keep from going into menopause. And I'm not sure where she is now with that, because she's at the age where you normally would go into menopause. But I just wanted to let you know that it doesn't bother me at all that you talked about this. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, My sister was one of the 1 in 10 that suffered from that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Judy, by the way, I appreciate your question. Judy asks me in a text, do we need to apologize for using women's disease in talks? No, we
no.
don't.
I liked your talk a lot, and I'm glad you, that's just a little aside, but it was a great talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
And I like to hear about women's things, and we should. Everybody should hear about women's things when it's pertinent.
I recommend the interview with Terry Gross. Terry Gross is interviewing Linda Griffith. You just look, Google Linda Griffith and NPR.
Linda Griffith. NPR. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.